Good afternoon. The time is 1:31 p.m. We're in Belts Room 105 of the Thomas Stewart Building in the nation's most beautiful capital city of Juneau, Alaska. Today is Monday, April 13th, 2026. Members present are Senator Dunbar, Senator Yunt, Senator Greg Jackson, Vice Chair Merrick, and myself, Senator Bjorkman. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Welcome, everyone, to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please turn off or silence your cell phones and join me in welcoming our recording secretary, Carrie Tupo, and our LAO moderator, Jude Augustine. On our agenda today, we have two items. First up is Senate Bill 111, Digital Product Repair. Following that will be Senate Bill 121, Health Insurance Allowable Charges. First up, Senate Bill 111. This is our second hearing on the bill. During our first hearing, we had a presentation of the bill and took invited testimony. I would like to invite the bill sponsor, the Honorable Senator Forrest Dunbar, and his staff, Halen Benkin, to the table to provide a brief recap of the bill. Please put yourselves on the record and begin your brief recap.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, everyone. Because of the composition of this committee, most folks here have heard this bill many times. But just as a brief recap, some manufacturers, deliberately make it more difficult for owners or independent repair technicians to repair devices. They do so by refusing to publish documentation, by using proprietary tools, hardware, and software locks, gluing parts together, and some other strategies. This bill helps to alleviate some of those concerns. It has broad bipartisan support. Since we have met last, it was received the endorsement of the Alaska Miners Association. There should be a letter in your packet for that. I thank the chair for working with my staff, and we've been working with the industry to revise the bill, and there should be a CS. And if you choose to bring it up today, my staff will present the differences in that draft. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for that recap, Senator Dunbar. Are there any questions for the sponsor or his staff at this time? We do thank you very much for the suggested changes in the committee substitute. Members have a draft committee substitute in their packet. May I have a motion, please?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move committee substitute for Senate Bill 111, version 34-LS0560/H as the working document.
Object for purposes of explanation. Mr. Benkin, would you please walk the committee through the changes that you all made in version H?
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Halen Benkin, staff to Senator Dunbar. This CS makes four changes, most of which are clarifying changes or updating the effective date. In Section 1, you'll find no changes. In Section 2, under AS 4545.820, you will find a new subsection clarifying that this bill would not conflict with any federal laws relevant to parts pairing requirements. Specifically, this was to address concerns raised by the printer industry about tracking requirements that they have to ensure preventing of counterfeiting and to track down any printed materials that are connected to crime, and they use parts pairing to do that. So we clarify that we do not conflict with this bill with any of those federal requirements that may exist. Also in Section 2, under Section 4545840, it modifies subsection A3A, clarifying the kinds of costs that a manufacturer or authorized service provider may charge in regards to making tools available. This is in response to a concern that came up in the House with the House version companion to this bill, HB 162. The language was a little unclear. It said preparing and sending the tool. And we always assumed and understood that that would include the cost of, like, actually creating, like, a wrench that you're sending out to someone if for some reason you're sending a specialized proprietary wrench. But legal said that was unclear, and so we've added the word producing into that section to clarify that creating that. It's not intended to cover the development costs of a tool, but just for the cost of making the unit of the tool that you're sending out. And then in subsection C, it modifies it to expand that provision, which allows dealers of large and heavy equipment to charge a reasonable markup on parts they provide to owners and independent providers. In the earlier drafts of the bill, this was limited first to farm equipment and then farm equipment and power sports equipment. Now it includes, as best as we can with this definition, that was sort of the the process was arriving with legal and a definition that we were satisfied with to include all kinds of large and heavy equipment that rely on that dealership model. And then conforming with that in section 4545899, it removes the definition of farm equipment, which legal felt was no longer necessary. And then finally, in section 6, it updates the effective date to January 1st, 2027. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That is all the changes in this version.
Very good. Are there any questions from committee members? Hearing and seeing none, I have a couple of questions. My first question is, would these changes kind of preserve the status quo for dealers who sell power plants for diesel-powered boats?
I think we can work further. Mr. Chairman, sorry. I believe we can work further on the definition of the bill if you have, and we're happy to talk about this with legal to, like, figure out exactly how they think this would be applied. I think we are establishing through legislative intent here that, like, the intention of this bill, and if the language currently does not conform to that, we want it to include allowing any dealer to make a reasonable markup, right? Any of these sectors that rely on that business model. We don't want to harm any of these local dealers' businesses. We don't want to have them be caught between this law and the manufacturers, like, passing all of the responsibility for complying with it onto them. Yeah, does that answer your question, Mr. Chairman?
Can you repeat that last part again? I didn't follow the last part of the answer.
Yeah. The concern that the dealers raised, right, is that because of that business model where the manufacturer does not interact with consumers directly at all, it's 100% through the dealership model. Like, that is all of the infrastructure for distributing these kinds of equipment. We don't want the manufacturer to say, well, in accordance with our normal business model, this responsibility of providing parts falls entirely on you, the Alaskan dealers. And then if the law, as is required for, like, many of the other kinds of products under this law, says you have to provide parts at cost, then the dealers are then required to bear this, what would be high costs of stocking and distributing these large pieces of, large parts for these, you know, bulky pieces of equipment. And so that's the genesis of this allowance, is that when you are dealing with this sort of unique business model and the unique kinds of large, bulky, heavy products that rely on this business model, there should be a consideration for the amount of cost associated with just acting as the intermediary between the manufacturers and the independent service providers or owners.
Understood. So in regards to that type of production of tools and then the provision of tools, a bit of a kind of just an anecdote from my personal experience. In a different life, I helped manage an archery shop. It was a dealer model, selling high-speed compound bows. And through that business, as the technology of bows changed, it required every archery shop everywhere to have different tools to accommodate the different technology that was built into the bow. You needed different sets of limb holders to compress a bow in a bow press. You needed a different style of bow vise to accommodate certain bows. But that wasn't provided for by the manufacturer of the bow, Hoyt or Bowtech or PSC. They didn't provide those. It was just understood that, hey, if you want to be our partner as a dealer, that you would update your toolbox essentially to work on this stuff. What about a piece of equipment, whether it's a Polaris four-wheeler or a John Deere power plant for a boat? What about working on those things and the tools make the tools so special that other manufacturers, a third party, couldn't build the tools to work on that equipment and then sell them to the people who want to work on it?
Mr. Chairman, I think you'll find in most cases that they can. You know, that most tools, like most wrenches, even if it's a pretty specialized wrench, someone else can make that wrench. What the tools often refers to is software tools. That is where we've had the biggest issues with repairability, and it's why this bill focuses on digital product repair, is because oftentimes, I mean, the famous example is John Deere tractors, where the farmer or an independent shop could perform a completely functional repair, and it might be something as simple as changing a filter, but then if they do not have the software tool to clear the like error code from the machine not accepting this new part, the machine, despite physically being fully functional, becomes almost inoperable because of that. And those software tools are, no third company can provide that software tool. John Deere actually just recently settled a lawsuit where they agreed to pay $90 million to a class action lawsuit over this issue. And there's another FTC lawsuit still pending against them. And they've been the sort of poster child, but this is a broader issue where with new products, there are often software tools that are required. And that's partially why we didn't think about the cost of like actually producing an individual copy of a tool earlier, is because mostly what we're concerned about is software tools for which there is no cost of producing a copy of the tool. And those are the sort of things that are proprietary and we think are mostly just used as an obstacle to repair, and we think manufacturers should have to provide.
Understood. Okay. No, that makes good sense, I think. I'm excited to hear from testimony. I'm sure more folks will talk about that, and that's good. Yeah, I think that's great. Anything further from committee members about this proposed CS? Hearing and seeing none, I will remove my objection. Hearing no further objection, committee substitute for Senate Bill 111, version 34-LS0560/H as in Huslia, is adopted as a working document. We will now go to public testimony. There are many people online who wish to testify. Before we go to public testimony, though, Deani Chapman is online and available for questions if folks want to reach out to her for questions as well. But at this time, we'll open public testimony on SB 111. Is there anyone in the room or online who wishes to testify? Anyone in the room? Seeing no one, we'll go online to Glenn Freifogel. Mr. Freifogel, please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony. You will have 2 minutes.
Thank you so much. I'm very thankful that I have you've given me a little time to testify here. I'll be honest, I was prepared to give you a detailed message here, but I found out at the last minute that it was limited to a couple of minutes. And I would ask that I get at least 5 or 6 minutes for what I have to say, because I'm going to have to chop this up into just points to cover. So here's the chopped up version.
Mr. Freifogel. So 1 second, Mr. Yeah. Freifogel. Yep. So typically for public testimony, we allow folks to testify for 2 minutes. However, if you have additional comments beyond a two-minute time frame, we urge you and everyone else to please submit written testimony that will be added to the bill record and the bill file to our email address. And that email address is slac at akleg.gov. SLAC at akleg.gov. Yep.
Mm-hmm. And I'll represent three companies, but I'll take 2 minutes here and give you what I have, okay?
Very good.
George Leitner of Alaska fame, everyone should know who that is. I used to buy televisions from him, the distributor in New Orleans, Louisiana. Every year he would send me a huge turkey and a gallon of whiskey every Thanksgiving and every Christmas, because people in that time would refuse to buy electronics or any type of device from people who wasn't sales and service. Okay, you know, when I charge $100 to fix a $400,000 item, that $100 goes back right here. It doesn't, like $800 and $50 goes to the dealer and $750 goes to China. There's a covert Cold War I've been fighting against for 31 years. See, the thing is that there's actual sabotage, and these bills that the manufacturers do, because if I fix just a thousand, 3 a day items a year, that is 1,000 items that the electronics departments or the dealers do not get sell. So they're not going to promote me. They're going to tell them what to tell everybody, and I there's nobody that fixes this stuff because everybody just throws it out and buys new stuff. The thing is that I've been doing this 47 years, and the thing is that I want to make myself available for anyone who wants to call me. I have 3,000 people a year that come to my front counter that I can take all the time I want with them and express my support for repair and why. You got actual sabotage going on with a lot of these items. To give you an idea, you know, like O-Man generators, spark plugs, have to tear it all to pieces to get a spark plug wrench on it. Makes me look like an idiot. To get the carburetor, I'll fix it or replace it. There's no tool. I have to manufacture a tool to get two nuts off. They do it on purpose. It's not by mistake. Razor sharp backs on TVs my techs cut their hands on that I have to warn them up front on the metal back. The list is a mile long of the things they do. Now, here's the solution. I remember a law, can't find it, went out sunset clause, year 2000. In 2000, before 2000, back to 1980, it was comprehensive. None of these bills, the points in these bills, has any comprehensive value at all. It specifies one item or one type of item.
Mr. Freifogel.
You should be able to supply, you could get stuff for 5 years, and that's what the law said, at a reasonable price, what a quorum of people would determine was a reasonable price.
Mr. Freifogel.
And 10 years at some cost.
Mr. Freifogel, your 2 minutes has expired. I'm so sorry.
I get it. Look, I get it. I get it. I'm very appreciated. I understand what y'all are doing. So that, you know,
could you please
47 years in 2 minutes. And
could
I
you
doubt
please,
anybody
sir,
to read my mail.
Mr. Freifogel.
I don't see it. I'll
Mr.
do the
Freifogel,
best I can.
Please.
Okay?
I just need you to say your name and affiliation for the record and tell us if you support or oppose the bill, sir.
My name is Glenn Freifogel, the Comtronics. Yes, I support any bill that supports repair that is comprehensive, not one or two items. Digital electronics, that's not very broad, but it's all we can get, probably.
Very good. Thank you so much for your testimony. We appreciate you.
Uh-huh. Bye.
We'll go next to Chad Tokowitz. Mr. Tokowitz, please state your name and affiliation for the record. You have 2 minutes.
Good afternoon, committee members. My name is Chad Tokowitz. I'm the government relations manager for the Marine Retailers Association of the Americas, a leading trade association of North American small businesses that sell and service new and pre-owned recreational boat and operation marinas, boat yards, and accessory stores. We represent more than 13,000 individual retail locations nationwide, including just under, I think, just two or three in Alaska. And I really want to highlight today, folks, that in marine retail, frankly, we do not oppose our consumers or customers' right to make repairs on their equipment. And in fact, many of our members work directly with their customers to provide the required parts and train them how to do simple repairs on their boats independently. So things like replacing spark plugs on your outboard, or maybe a water pump if the water pump goes. Simple things like that, or an oil change. If it's easier for that to be done by someone at home, we have parts departments that are dedicated to putting those parts in the hands of our customers. However, we do oppose providing access to the proprietary code of products that our members sell due to concerns of safety, emissions, compliance, and product reliability. And as the gentleman said before, this is all about software. And the software that you're going to allow folks to have access to under this legislation will provide a level of access to untrained individuals that would frankly negatively affect the product compliance with federal safety, security, and emission standards. So not only is there a risk of putting consumers and the boating public in danger, but marine manufacturers are required by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency under 40 Code of Federal Regulations 1068.5 to ensure that, quote, adjustable parameters, end quote, aren't able to be tampered with by unauthorized technicians, ensuring engines maintain their safety and emissions protocols. And so currently, the extent of that access is strictly limited by the EPA and the Clean Air Act. And so to comply with the Clean Air Act and meet EPA mandates, recreational marine engine manufacturers cannot provide access to pollution control devices. And so really what we are worried about is consumers getting the software or getting the ability to access and change the software within these marine engines and then altering the way that these engines operate and putting them out of compliance with federal emission standards. I'm going to submit written testimony that references references a guidance put out by previous EPA Assistant Administrator Susan Bodine from November 23rd, 2020.
Thank you for that, sir.
Why this is such a concern for us.
Excellent.
And last but not least, I would just say we oppose this bill as currently drafted and would encourage you to exempt any marine products, vessels, as well as all off-road and non-road vehicles because the same emissions compliance.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Tokowitz.
As well.
Up next, we have Stephen Ryan. Mr. Ryan, please state your name and affiliation for the record. You have 2 minutes.
Good afternoon, Committee and Chair. My name is Stephen Ryan from Ryan Labs in Vancouver, Washington. Washington is a right to repair state. I thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of SB 111. As you know, every food product has a nutrition label. You know exactly what's in it. You can compare products, make an informed choice, and hold manufacturers accountable. By law, you can read the warranty and ingredients before you spend a dime. Electronics consumers deserve that same standard. Before 1990, TVs, video game consoles, appliances, and other things came with the schematics printed right on them or tucked inside the case or the manual the manufacturer provided. You could fix what you owned. Manufacturers took that away and forced Americans to accept it. Today, they plaster devices AI-powered or next generation, claiming but won't show you the bill of materials or the schematic. Many times it's the same hardware as last model with a software update, new shape, color, and a price tag. If the manufacturer claims they don't have those documents, then they aren't designing or manufacturing what they're selling. That is fraud. The documents are required to manufacture the device. This bill fixes that. It requires manufacturers to document, to make documentations, parts, and tools available on fair, reasonable terms with few exemptions for manufacturers to exploit. That matters to individuals, businesses, and families forced to replace a device that needs a $5 chip or the firmware for that chip. And it matters for oil field crews in the North Slope who cannot wait months for an authorized technician or for a replacement device. Up there in the middle of the winter, being locked out of your own equipment isn't just expensive. It can be life-threatening, such as a heater, an ATV, or other equipment being disabled after a repair because of software, a tool, is not made available by approving the repair or clearing the codes. Consumers deserve a nutrition label and strong exemption-free consumer protections from their technology they own. I urge your support in passing Senate Bill 111. Any questions? Thank you. I can provide many documentations of how the manufacturers are twisting the exemptions here in Washington State, show you physical examples of the exact same device. The only thing different is the code on a chip.
Thank you for your testimony, sir. We'll go next to Jake Bronger. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony. You have 2 minutes.
Yes, hello, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jake Bronger, and I'm speaking on behalf of NRG Energy and our affiliate, Vivint Smart Home. We appreciate the intent behind the bill. Expanding repair access for everyday electronics is a good goal, and we support that in principle. But we did want to highlight a few critical issues and how the bill is written. The definition of a, quote, digital product, end quote, is very broad. It would clearly include security and life safety systems, things like intrusion alarms, access controls, fire detection, carbon monoxide monitoring, and security cameras. And under this bill, manufacturers would be required to provide documentation such as password and reset codes, tools, and access related to security features. And that's where our concern is. In our industry, that information isn't just about repair. It can be used to disable systems, bypass protections, or expose vulnerabilities. That reduces the integrity of these systems and creates real public safety risks. This bill could unintentionally put sensitive system information in the hands of untrained individuals or bad actors, which creates real risk for systems people rely on in emergencies. Think false alarms, alarm signals that fail to send, and cameras that are hacked or jammed entirely. Other states have recognized this issue. In fact, all states, including Washington, Oregon, and California, that have passed digital electronic right to repair have exempted security life safety systems and devices from the law. Alaska's bill in its current form does not do that. We're asking not to limit the broader purpose of this legislation. We're simply asking for a targeted exemption to ensure that we don't unintentionally put public safety at risk. At Vivint, we're responsible for protecting over 12,000 Alaskan families, and we're concerned this legislation would undermine the integrity of these systems that we rely on. A narrow exemption for the security and life safety systems would strike the right balance and align Alaska with all other states that have addressed this issue. Thank you for time and consideration.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bronger. We'll go next to Quentin Churio. Mr. Churio, please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony. You have 2 minutes.
My name is Quentin Churio. I own a business, Hughes Tech Service. Hello. I would like to see this bill pass. Let me start off. Hello, my name is Quentin Searle. I own a small shop called Hughes Tech Service in Racine, Wisconsin. I repair lots of game consoles sent from all over. Electronics that we purchased back in the day, they used to have schematics on the back of the radios, inside televisions, refrigerators, washers, and dryers. But nowadays, they do not offer them. Why is that? Why should the consumer, keep purchasing new game consoles, forced to buy new systems instead of getting them repaired by a small repair shop like me? People are on a strict budget. Single parents can't afford to just go buy a new game console every time it breaks. The game consoles keep the kids out of trouble and out of the streets. They're good babysitters nowadays. People would like to get them repaired, but can't because companies will not provide schematics, known as a roadmap, or parts nowadays. Passing this would help us get those items. I feel if this bill was passed, it would help Alaska people out, not forcing them to buy a new system. We want the right to repair our own devices. This bill would help small businesses repair these devices and keep them out of landfills. Help us help Alaska people repair their own devices so they don't have to spend 4 paychecks replacing a game console and forced to buy a new one. Help us put food back on the table for small families in Alaska. That's all I have to say. Thanks for hearing me.
Thank you very much, Mr. Churro. I'm just interested, curious, I guess. From Racine, Wisconsin, how did you hear about our bill in the hearing today?
I just know about it's known in the repair community that we need to be able to, basically we need schematics. We're not asking for code, you know, for these devices and stuff like that. We want schematics. Therefore, we know what the test, voltage levels, stuff like that. We could repair a broken system that doesn't power up on a motherboard. Therefore, we don't have that. We have to reverse engineer, or we have to go off a schematic that falls off in China off a truck and hope we get our hands on a schematic.
Gotcha.
But I would like to be able to see this passed so people have the right to repair their own devices for everything.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you for your testimony.
That's how I feel about it. So, yep.
Thank you.
Thanks.
We'll go next to Nathan Riggins. Mr. Riggins, please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony. You have 2 minutes.
Yes, hello. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Nathan Riggins. I'm the Director of Government Affairs at the Associated Equipment Distributors, or AED. We're the trade association comprised of companies that sell, rent, and service equipment used in agriculture, construction, forestry, mining, and power generation, other applications, including many members in Alaska. Our industry is made up of small to medium-sized independent family-owned businesses that provide well-paid jobs for Alaskans and serve as a positive force within communities throughout the state. And I'll say our dealers respectfully oppose SB 111. We see it as unnecessary in the off-road space and see that it's based on the false premise that customers are unable to fix their own machinery. On the contrary, equipment dealers like ours and manufacturers support customers' ability to repair their equipment and make available all diagnostic tools, repair information, parts, and remote customer support. As a point of fact, a significant percentage of parts sales for our members are sold directly to customers over the counter so they can repair their own equipment. Diagnostic tools are widely available on a subscription basis, and documentation is likewise widely available online at fair prices. Equipment dealers and manufacturers do everything possible to keep equipment running. That can mean repairs completed by a dealership service technician, the customer, or commonly in Alaska by a third-party provider, because when equipment is not operating, that means lost money for customers. Often repairs can be diagnosed remotely, and when necessary, our dealers will dispatch technicians to remote areas to make sophisticated repairs. This legislation's ambiguous requirements related to parts sales will cause confusion without real benefit to customers or third-party repair providers. Software tools, hard tools, documentation, manuals, and access to repair to manufacturer systems would completely alter the equipment industry's distribution model and would put countless Alaska equipment dealerships at risk. Manufacturers and customers rely on a robust network of independent, family-owned companies to sell, rent, and service their equipment. These dealers make significant investments in their employees, including training service technicians to repair and maintain the latest high technology machinery. Given the concerns that we have with SB 111, we would urge you to adopt an exemption language that protects customer interests in the equipment industry. This language is based on language that's been adopted in the past by states like New York, Minnesota, Oregon, Washington, and Texas, as well as a number of other states which have exempted heavy-duty off-road equipment, like those that our dealers service in Alaska. If you've not seen the language yet, I'm happy to arrange to have it sent to you and can submit it in written testimony later on. I appreciate your consideration of our concerns, and if you have any questions, I'm open to hearing.
Thank you very much, Mr. Riggins. We'll go next to Mr. Chuck Winters. Mr. Winters, please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chairman Borkman and committee members. My name is Chuck Winters. I am the location manager for Airport Equipment Rental 2 on the Kenai Peninsula. Respectfully, our company opposes SB 111 as currently written. First, I want to thank the bill sponsor for the changes to the parts sales language as it relates to construction equipment in Section 4545A40. However, we strongly believe that off-road equipment belongs in Section 4545A95, titled exemptions. Why do we hold that position? Contrary to the testimonies made at various times, there is no manufacturer of off-road equipment that has a prohibition against owners or independent shops repairing their equipment. Nothing is further from the truth. We support every customer's right to repair. We support those who wish to repair their own equipment or have an independent service provider to do the work for them. Manufacturers in the off-road equipment space are moving to meet customers where they live on this issue. Our leading OEM and other competitive brands provide access to parts, manuals, documentation, and diagnostic tools, and they continue to expand off-road repair support nationwide, including for Alaskan customers in rural and remote areas. Our dealership has over 40 users successfully utilize John Deere's ProService diagnostic tool, and we support those users on an ongoing basis. Our users include miners, oil field maintenance companies, energy providers, and independent service shops that rely on us daily to support their efforts Soon those users will have expanded access to manufacturer systems as well. The mandate provides diagnostic tools, hard tools, manuals, and access to manufacturer systems free of charge is unreasonable and will impair the value of our contracts with our OEM partners and the value of the business that our owners have invested in and grown over the last 40 years. Furthermore, the mandate will place a drag on market-driven innovation of customer product support tools. Free of charge does not attract investment by manufacturers or dealers. It will no doubt drive up product costs as the cost of providing the mandated assets must go at somewhere else. Alaska equipment owners and independent providers rely on a healthy dealer community support them with parts inventory, application expertise, capable and timely technical support, and consistently high standards of product support. Finally, it is puzzling the fact that the auto industry operates under an MOU in place that avoids a patchwork of these state laws. The MOU provides that a diagnostic tool will be made available on a subscription basis, not at no charge. Meanwhile, in this bill, our industry mandate is to provide diagnostic tools, hard tools, access to systems, and manuals free of charge. There obviously is an imbalance being considered that is unreasonable. Respectfully, I submit that the free market is working, and that for reasons provided, we ask that SB 111 does not pass as written, and that the off-road equipment be exempted from that bill. Thanks for your time, guys.
Thank you very much, Mr. Winters. Up next is Zach Siebold. Mr. Siebold, please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony. You have 2 minutes.
Good afternoon, Chair, Senator Bjorkman, and committee members. For the record, my name is Zach Siebold. I'm a lifelong Alaskan and the regional parts manager for Pepe Kenworth, Alaska. Serving customers from Dutch Harbor to Prudhoe Bay, Pepe also operates Ditchwick West and material handling dealerships, supporting a wide range of industries across the state. SB 111 has significant unintended consequences for customer service and safety, particularly for utility, construction, agriculture, warehousing, and aerial equipment. As dealers, we are held to a high manufacturer standard for part availability, training, customer support, including warranty. Equipment today is highly advanced, requiring specialized digital and technical expertise to maintain safety and effectively. This is exactly what customers rely on us to provide. At Pepe, we invest heavily in Alaska, carrying millions of dollars in parts inventory and training our employees to support both remote and local customers. We troubleshoot over the phone, we fly experts out to train and repair, research parts, and provide access to technical training to keep fleets running. SB 111 will require manufacturers to offer wholesale pricing to independent repair providers and customers who do not share the same obligation. That is unprecedented and would create serious financial strain on dealer networks that are obligated to provide warranty, support, and know-how and local parts on hand with their investment. And this damage would in turn impact our availability of these essential items for our customers. There is also a huge misconception that manufacturers like John Deere and Ditch Witch restrict access to parts and repair information. In our experience, that is simply not true. Our goal is to keep equipment running and customers productive, regardless of how they choose to service their equipment. I've been in the parts sector in Alaska for 26 years and strive on customer service and providing services like mechanical support, parts needs, and technical drawings, just to name a few. It's what we do and it's what our customers expect. SB 111 should exclude off-road vehicles, equipment, and marines. These help us ensure Alaska dealerships can continue supporting the industries that depend on us. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We'll go next to Ali Peck. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony, please.
Hi, my name is Ali Peck, and I represent the Consumer Technology Association. We respectfully oppose Senate Bill 111, Digital Product Repair. We have submitted written testimony. CTA is the trade association representing the U.S. consumer technology industry, and our membership includes the manufacturers of the devices, TVs, computers, phones, game consoles, et cetera, subject to the provisions of this legislation. GTA has concerns with SB 111, which include broad and vague language, and it extremely is misaligned with industry stance on repair. The language is also misaligned with the current repair laws in eight other states that all went through heavy negotiation within the legislature. GTA's concerns center around three areas. One, enforcement via private right of action is our top concern. No state repair law allows for private right of action. Enforcement should be held by the Attorney General. Next, the definition of digital product is broad, raising a multitude of concerns and trickle impacts, including the capturing of critical infrastructure devices, business-to-business, and business-to-government products. Finally, there is a lack of parameters around the provisioning of documentation, tools, and parts in line with what manufacturers provide their own authorized repair providers as recognized in other states. Most repair bills focus on providing consumers with options to repair their products. SB 111 goes far beyond the typical consumer product in scope of these proposals and does little to provide reasonable accommodation for manufacturers, which have invested heavily in supporting consumers as well as independent and authorized repair providers. CTA, along with TechNet, does support repair. We have a model repair bill language, and we're happy to discuss with the legislature. But given these concerns that I've just spoken about, we strongly encourage Alaska not to move forward with SB 111. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Peck. We'll go next to Michael Rice. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony. You have 2 minutes.
Good afternoon. My name is Michael Rice. I am the second with the Roman numeral 2 for the record. I am the owner of Yeti Game Repairs and the head technician for Video Game Depot here in Anchorage, Alaska. First, I would like to express my deepest thanks for the members of the Senate for giving me the opportunity to speak today in support of Senate Bill 111 as it is written. This bill does empower Alaskans with the right to repair their own electronic devices and equipment. It helps reduce costs for consumers, increases access to repair services both in rural and urban communities, and it also promotes the local business growth. Senate Bill 111, as it is written, ensures that manufacturers provide the necessary software, tools, parts, and information required for proper diagnostics and repair. This does help extend the lifespan of products, reduces unnecessary waste, and in the past, these resources were actually included. Great examples are arcade and pinball machines from Midway's, Bally's. Even Nintendo had these with them. In the 80s, when you bought a Nintendo Entertainment System, you could go back to your local store, and on the spot, Nintendo had parts available for you to repair your own console or for that store to repair it for you. It is extremely important that this passes, and I have several instances, including PlayStation 5s that are sitting here in my shop, taking much longer than necessary because we do not have the proper diagnostics codes to be able to track down these repairs quicker. There are several instances. The opposing side will tell you that schematics in the wrong hands is malicious and could be bad. So can a cheese cutter. So can a steak knife, so can a million other things. They'll also try to tell you that if you give access to local repair companies to the software, you put everyone at risk. There were several instances, one in 2019, one in 2021, where the opposing side's company, one of them being Apple, had instances where an employee texted himself intimate photos from a customer's device, and another one uploaded them to Facebook. So far, the only real instance like this that happened with a private-owned company was a private-owned company that had a political figure's MacBook that was abandoned at his shop and reached out to FBI for several months asking them what to do with it. In the end, nothing that he had was tampered with and eventually got to the FBI, but he sat on it for months. All that stuff to the side, I really do believe by the heart of my heart that this is something that should be pushed, and I significantly and respectfully urge the passing of Senate Bill 111. Thank you very much for your time, and I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you for your testimony. We'll go next to Andrew O'Connor. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony, please.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Andrew O'Connor. I am testifying on behalf of the Entertainment Software Association in opposition to Senate Bill 111. ESA is the voice and advocate for the U.S. video game industry. I have submitted written testimony and provided a number of points of information to the committee, so I will just hit on a couple key points from that testimony. First and foremost, as has been noted, several states have already passed digital right to repair laws with video game consoles exemptions in them. This includes Washington, California, Texas, and most recently Kansas in the past week or so. Video game console exemption, as we have proposed, was agreed to by all of the main proponents and lawmakers working on this issue in those states. We ask if this bill moves forward, please follow the lead of those other states and ensure consistency across those laws. And to the issues with the bill underlying, first and foremost, piracy. In my written testimony and in the materials I have submitted to the committee, piracy continues to be one of the biggest threats to our industry, and allowing for unfettered and unregulated repair and modification of video game consoles makes it easier for bad actors to distribute and use unauthorized digital goods. In a world where games can spread like wildfire across the internet, piracy leads to many real-world issues, first and foremost for the government, depriving federal and state government of tax revenue generated by legitimate game sales, and then potentially exposing consumers to malware on privacy websites and or packaged with the pirated software materials. Additionally, Senate Bill 111 fails to properly address copyright concerns. Section 4545.810 of the proposed substitute conflicts directly with copyright law as providing the tools that could circumvent the technological protection measures in consoles would violate federal law and put copyrighted materials at risk. Video game consoles employ digital locks designed to protect their game consoles and provide a secure media environment for players and other video game publishers and developers. And then lastly, I want to state our member commitment to fast repairs. There's been mentions of consoles not being repaired or costing a lot of money. All three console makers perform hundreds of console repairs annually for Alaskans, and all three strive to have very quick turnaround and low-cost repairs. That includes shipping to the facility, the repair itself, and the return to the customer. This is faster and more reliable than a independent repair shop when factoring in the time it would take to diagnose the issue, request the parts, receive the parts, and then execute the repair without having any issues or damages. So again, I've submitted written testimony and materials. Thank you so much for your consideration, and please either amend this bill to align with other states or not advance it entirely. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. O'Connor. Up next, Eric Wareham. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Eric Wareham. I am Vice President of Government Affairs for the North American Equipment Dealers Association. We represent about 3,500 farm, industrial, and outdoor power equipment dealers across North America. We are respectfully opposing the bill as written, and without trying to duplicate some of the other folks that have talked about this from the non-road sector, I'll just add that in the last 10 years since this bill has been an issue, the trend recently has been to have an exemption for non-road equipment. There's currently 7 states with a non-road exemption that was referenced earlier. So that's soon to be 8 with Kansas passing a bill. And that trend exists for a reason, because our products are different with a distinction. And I want to thank the bill sponsor for recognizing the dealer model, the changes that they've made to the parts of cost language. However, it doesn't negate the concerns we have relating to safety and emissions. Those still exist. And the reason those other states have exempted non-road equipment, including marine vessels, passenger vessels, and heavy-duty off-road equipment, is because largely for us, the MOUs that exist, those memorandums of understanding that I assume or presume is the reason that the motor vehicle sector is exempted from this bill, those also exist between manufacturers and the American Farm Bureau Federation, and they have for 3 years now. And those MOUs are living documents that do a much better job and go into greater detail than legislation would about providing self-repair offerings to owners and independent repair shops. And what I mean by living documents is they're reassessed every 6 months, and there is also a dispute resolution mechanism included in those. And in the last 3 years, there have only been two disputes that have been raised and resolved to consumer satisfaction. So I would urge the committee to look at why those other states have included a non-road exemption, and we are more than willing to provide that. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Up next, Amy Seitz. Ms. Seitz, please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
Well, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Amy Seitz. I'm the policy director for Alaska Farm Bureau. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today regarding Senate Bill 111 and the right to repair. And obviously, I will be focusing on right to repair as it relates to agriculture. In agriculture, timing is everything. When equipment fails during the narrow windows we have for planting and harvesting, it doesn't just cause a delay, it can be devastating. Finding an ag equipment technician, whether they're authorized or independent, is a challenge, especially in rural Alaska, and hauling equipment is often not feasible. This is why right to repair has been a priority for our members for years. However, we are asking you to exclude agriculture from this bill. We're not asking for less protection for our farmers. We're asking to protect a solution that is already working. In 2023, the American Farm Bureau Federation reached the landmark MOU with John Deere, and I've heard other people mention it today. And it's been followed by similar agreements with other major manufacturers for agriculture equipment. These private sector agreements already provide what our farmers need. They provide access, parts and support, and agility. Farmers and independent shops have access to diagnostic codes, service manuals, and specialized tools. The agreements ensure access to the parts and ordering assistance required to get machines back on the field and working. These MOUs are reviewed and updated regularly, and they allow for a much faster resolution than the process of changing state laws. A patchwork of different state-by-state laws risks making compliance expensive and complicated for manufacturers, which will ultimately result in higher costs for Alaska farmers and ranchers. We have a national private sector solution in place that is functional, consistent, and effective. We respectfully urge this committee to allow these MOUs to continue their work and to remove agriculture from the scope of Senate Bill 111. I thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much, Ms. Seitz. We'll go next to Russell Bukta. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
Hi, how you doing? My name is Russell Bukta. I'm the owner of RB Generators and Rusty Rust Repairs. I've been a fixer my whole life. I have a small homestead, and I'm always fixing something, either it's for my animals or a small engine or generator or fixing some kind of electronics. I really do enjoy working with my hands and problem solving, but I've seen firsthand how companies hinder the right to repair, whether that's a generator controller being backfilled with silicone to prevent diagnostics or phone and game consoles being paired with certain components, causing the device to be unrepairable if you try to replace any of the components. A controller costs about $1,500 to $2,000 when it could be just a blown capacitor or something simple. I understand that companies have, you know, their intellectual property over software, but hardware should be repairable. I believe companies should release schematics and components to the general public. I'm still new to electronic repairs, but I fully support the right to repair and SB 111, and I want to encourage everyone to be able to repair any equipment that they own. Allowing people to repair allows them to earn a living, support their families, and that's what the American dream is about. So I am in full support of SB 111. Thank you for your time.
Very good, Mr. Bukta. Up next, Mark Carrico. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
My name is Mark Carrico. I am the owner of Affordable Cell Phone Repair and other electronics. I do not have a speech, but I'm just going to wing it from the hip. I not only repair cell phones and tablets, but also repair gaming consoles as well.
I'm just going to give a quick few examples that should not be. As far as like cell phones go, Apple products, if you take a brand new Apple right out of the box, take a brand new Apple right out of the box, the same exact model, same exact color even, you don't even turn it on, and you swap any of the parts over, it's going to say it's a non-authorized Apple product. That shouldn't be, that shouldn't happen. That is pure and plain utter greed from corporations. Another example would be Xbox Series S and Series X. Previous consoles prior to that had regular HDD hard drives inside of them. If your hard drive went bad, all you have to do is go get another hard drive, put it inside, or have a technician put it inside, download the software onto your Xbox, and you're golden. Now, the SSD that's inside of the Series X and the Series S is married to a motherboard, so every single $700 console, and they're about to go up in price yet again, every single $700 console that people are buying will die. 10 years from now, you will not find somebody that grew up with an Xbox Series S or Xbox Series X having one fully functional, specifically because of 100% greed. Greed needs to stop from these corporations. That's all that's the reason behind this, is 100% agree. I do agree with some stipulations that you can't provide like different schematics for like security reasons and this and that and the other. But if that has anything to do with greed, greed is not good. So I just wanted to give those a couple of examples that some things need to be rewritten. Some laws need to be changed. We do have the right to repair our own stuff. I mean, you can't just go out and buy a brand new car, drive down the road, and your tire becomes flat and say, oh, I've got to buy a new car because I don't have the right to repair. That's all I got to say.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Up next, Christopher Hall. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
Hi, my name is Christopher Hall. I'm the owner and operator of 8-Bit Repair, located in Athens, Georgia, obligated by the diversity of the state. Go Dawgs. So my company primarily focuses on game consoles, kind of like my colleagues before me, but we do other repairs for everyday electronics, PCs, you know, TV boards, and even children's toys. I don't really have speech repair, but I just want to echo the colleagues before me. So yeah, I just want to say that I am in support of SB111. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hall. We'll go next to Isaac Mailer. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony, please.
Hello, and thank you, Mr. Chair and members of this committee for taking my testimony. My name is Isaac Mailer, no affiliation. I'm a sole proprietor and independent repair technician. I'm calling you from Grand Rapids, Michigan. I work out of my home electronics lab, and I purchase, repair, refurbish, and then resell lab electronics and metrology equipment. Repair has literally been my passion since early childhood, when I would buy broken electronics at yard sales to take them apart. I'm calling to voice my strong support for SB 111. There is an unacceptable degree of waste and consumer abuse that results from companies locking customers into devices and device ecosystems, which denies or restricts repair, or otherwise forces customers to participate in a cycle of planned obsolescence, where they are forced to throw away the products they bought and paid for with their hard-earned and increasingly limited money, and constantly buy new devices rather than effect cheap, economical repairs, either themselves or through an unaffiliated repair business. This behavior does nothing except abuse customers and unjustly enrich corporations, while also being incredibly wasteful with material resources such as copper and rare earth minerals, not to mention the total life cycle energy costs of manufacturing and the environmental impact which results from this pile of waste. This bill will protect the consumer rights of Alaskans while at the same time contributing to the reduction of environmental harm and waste of resources. It will remove a great deal of the chokehold that prevents small and medium-sized electronics repair businesses from operating and flourishing, helping to create jobs in Alaska, and at the same time contributing to keep money spent by Alaskans in the state of Alaska and strengthening local economies. We've heard a number of corporate representatives call in and explain how they support consumer rights, but then go on to the classic refrain of rules for thee, not for me, claiming the bill should be revised to exempt them or should be discarded entirely. They claim that empowering Alaskans would harm their corporations economically. What should our elected officials care about more, the rights of their constituents or the profits of corporations? I urge you, do not weaken this bill with a long list of exemptions. Vote in favor of the rights and economic success of your constituents. Vote in favor of your constituents paying fellow Alaskans for the repair and maintenance of their own property, rather than that money going out of the state to large corporations. Thank you kindly for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Mailer. I'm curious, what type of equipment is metrology equipment?
Metrology is a term referring to the science of measurement. In its simplest term, a ruler is a piece of metrology equipment. At the same further end of the spectrum, a laser micrometer that can measure down to a 10,000th or a 100,000th or a millionth of an inch is a piece of metrology equipment, just as a multimeter that can measure voltage or current, anything that conducts measurement. That is one of my passions and my area of expertise.
Fascinating. Thank you very much. We'll go next to Mr. Justin Castle. Mr. Castle, welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony. You have 2 minutes.
Hello to the chair, the committee, and your afternoon. And thank you for the time to speak. For the record, my name is Justin Castle. I'm the owner and operator of Eagle River Electronics, an independent repair shop focusing on repairs and servicing of consumer electronics of all kinds. I am calling to voice support for Senate Bill 111 on behalf of myself, my business, and my community. Today, I just wanted to highlight a recent real-world impact that this bill could help in the future. Perhaps some of you have seen the recent news regarding Amazon and Kindle devices. Just a quick recap for those who haven't. Kindle devices are a tablet created by Amazon. It's the Amazon version of an iPad. They run proprietary Amazon software and are restricted to Amazon-only use. Just this past weekend, Amazon has summarily deactivated hundreds of thousands of fully functional Amazon Kindle devices for no reason other than they want you to buy a new one. If you have an old Kindle device, you can no longer connect, download any new products, or use it to communicate. In essence, the next time you try to update anything on your device, it will become bricked and cease to function entirely. I represent just a small part of Alaska. At roughly 15,000 residents, Eagle River is around 2% of Alaska's total population. And I am just a small shop that doesn't necessarily hear from everyone in my community. But in just the last 3 days since this happened, I have already received 6 calls from clients about their Kindle devices no longer working, devices they have used for years suddenly failing. That's 6 calls. You extrapolate that across the whole of Alaska, and that is at least 300 Alaskans in just the last 3 days that have had their several hundred dollar devices taken away from them. That's 300 of your constituents over this weekend alone who have been virtually robbed of their property. The best I can tell them is, sorry, Amazon disabled them, and there's no legal recourse. They're allowed to do that to you until something like Senate Bill 111 passes. Senate Bill 111 guarantees the public access to tools, and as defined in Section 4545-899 definitions, Part 10, tools include software tools that can be used to prevent or remove any software locks Amazon decides to put on there for nothing but corporate greed for the profits of their shareholders against the best interest of Alaskan citizens. And this is just recent news. If you pay attention to these things, stuff like this happens every week over and over all across the industry. Passing Senate Bill 111 will not retroactively change the past, but it will mean devices purchased tomorrow will not face the same problem.
passing Senate Bill 111 would be standing up for all Alaskans and telling them that you want them to have things they paid hundreds of dollars for to not be disabled against their will by a soulless corporation, but to be under their control. Keeping the power in the hands of Alaskans for the things they purchased is what senators should value. All the voices calling in today in opposition to Senate Bill 111 are representing corporations and associations and other non-Alaskans. You have not had one voice that simply represents an actual Alaskan citizen speak against Senate Bill 111.
Mr. Castle, your time has expired.
I encourage you to think about that and who you're supposed to represent. That's all I have today. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. We'll go next to Mr. Mark Aranda. Mr. Aranda, please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
Mark. Mr. Chairman, can you hear me?
We can, sir. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Well, Mr. Chair and Committee, my name is Mark Arata. I am Director of Government Affairs for the National Electronic Gold Manufacturers Association. EMA represents over 300 leading manufacturers in the electro industry, and in Alaska, that industry supports over 228 jobs with a labor income of $20 million. Most all right to repair bills cross-country are aimed at consumer electronic products, which you've heard a lot about today, ensuring that individuals can repair phones, computers, and other personal devices. Indeed, this legislation amends the Alaska Unfair Trade Practices and Consumer Protection Act. Therefore, if the author's intention is to focus on consumers, it would be extremely appropriate to be clear that this legislation is not intended to affect business-to-business or business-to-government transactions. NEMA is also suggesting language that would prevent indirect disclosure of trade secrets through access to firmware embedded in so many products, encryption keys, diagnostic tools, and similar mechanisms. By adding in the trade secret definition section, or provide any means by which a trade secret could be ascertained or indirectly disclosed. The legislation also puts intellectual property at risk. The company spend years and significant amount of money and labor to innovate, develop, and manufacture. Now, there is strong precedent by the National Electric Code, NEC, against repairability of lighting products, stating that reconditioned luminaires, lamp holders, ballast, LED drivers, lamps, and retrofit kits shall not be permitted. Lighting products are already designed for replaceability of certain components where safe to do so. Including the following language will avoid any further confusion. Language which was added into the Kansas legislation, quote, nothing in this bill shall be construed to require an original equipment manufacturer to provide parts, tools, or documentation for any product where reconditioning or repair of the product is prohibited by law, regulation, code, or where doing so will create a potential for unsafe operating conditions. NEMA has continued to commit to continue working with you to ensure consumers have access to repairs that ensure their privacy, safety, and security are protected. But for these reasons outlined in this testimony, we are currently in opposition to Senate Bill 111 in its current form and ask that the committee would please take a careful look at the suggestions we have made. Mr. Chairman, thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the room or online who wishes to testify to this item? Seeing and hearing none, at this time I'll close public testimony on Senate Bill 111. That brings this bill back before the committee. Is there any committee discussions or questions for the bill sponsor? Also available online for questions is Deani Chapman. Seeing and hearing no questions or comments, I would just simply note that public hearing was probably the had the most variety of different voices from around parts of Alaska and really around the country that I've ever seen. We had small business owners from Racine, Wisconsin, from Grand Rapids, Michigan, from Georgia, from Hearsay, maybe that's Hearst, California, Buchanan, West Virginia, Athens, Georgia. I felt that was impressive. So for the thousands in attendance and the millions watching around the world, well done, Senator Dunbar. Do you have any closing comments before we set the bill aside?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we could, I think my staffer, Mr. Benkin, has a couple of direct points that we'd like to make before we move on, just responding to some of the things that were said in public testimony.
Absolutely. Very good.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
First point, as you noted about the national interest in this bill, it is a national issue. Some other states have passed versions of the right to repair. Alaska's version, SB 111, is an ambitious version of right to repair. You heard a lot today about various exemptions that were made in other places and that industry thinks should be made here. Those exemptions broadly are not in this bill because we believe that this bill is good for consumers, the right to repair, giving options, giving freedom, giving control over the things that people and businesses have bought is good for those people and those businesses, that keeping repair and life cycle extension, like you heard about from the man with the measuring machines, allowing those sorts of businesses to flourish in Alaska for a wide variety of products, every product included, is a benefit to Alaska. Pushing this expansive, this bold version of the bill is going to have people testifying in opposition, but I think we can follow in the lead of places like the European Union that have pushed a more broad version. And every time we see one jurisdiction add a broader version of the bill, we see real change. Apple's newest product, the MacBook Neo, in responding to some of the European regulations that are coming in around laptops, is their most repairable product to date. Every right to repair bill that's passed has knock-on consequences because we are in this interconnected world and these companies do operate around the country. Specifically on some of the marine and off-road vehicle exemptions that were requested by perhaps the largest number of testifiers today. They talked about the software controlling emissions. The EPA has clarified under both the Biden and Trump administrations that right to repair is not incompatible with these emissions control software, and that, in fact, allowing a big point is that the emissions control software and the way that the manufacturers use that as an excuse to crack down a repair is why people prefer to continue on with older equipment. And that older equipment is much dirtier than even the, like, hypothetically, maybe someone modifies and messes up the emissions controls in the newer devices. And people want control over their own devices, and if these software systems are not giving it to them, then they choose to use older equipment. Several cabinet members in the current administration recently wrote an op-ed in favor of right to repair for off-road engines specifically because they recognize the essential nature of these products and keeping them running for users. We also heard about diagnostics being available on a subscription basis. That has been a major problem with the current auto industry MOU in that those subscriptions often cost thousands and thousands of dollars and make them essentially prohibitive for, you know, the true small independent mechanic that you think about. They talked about how they already make parts and tools available, and that just illustrates the demand that exists for these services and why we should not be put. We should try to reduce the obstacles as much as possible.
Okay. That's good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Senator Dunbar. We appreciate you bringing the changes forward that are represented in the CS. I did find it fascinating that we had Alaskans representing large constituencies testify both in favor of some changes to the bill and in favor of the bill as it sits currently, advocating for a certain level of exemption or not. I'm looking forward to working with those stakeholders as well as your office to continue to improve this bill and make it so that we can gain a broad base of support. Thank you very much.
You.
This time we'll set Senate Bill 111 aside for further consideration at a future meeting. We'll take a brief at ease while we set up for our next bill. We're back on the record. It's 2:46 p.m. now here in Senate Labor and Commerce. Our final item of today is Senate Bill 121. This is our third hearing on the bill. During previous hearings, we had a presentation of the bill and took invited testimony, as well as we adopted a committee substitute version W as the working document. Welcome back to Senate Labor and Commerce, the Honorable Senator Kathy Geisel. Please provide a brief recap of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Kathy Geisel, representing Senate District E in Anchorage. This is another metrology bill, Mr. Chairman, measuring things. In this case, we're talking about insurance and measuring the cost of for clinicians to maintain their practices. Just brief review, reminding people this is about the 80th percentile rule, which was repealed. The outcome that was expected was that insurance premiums would go down as a result of decreasing physician or healthcare clinician reimbursement. However, no floor was set. No floor for reimbursement, that is minimum reimbursement, was set. So as a result, insurers have canceled contracts, decreased reimbursement, less than 175% of Medicare in many cases, and contract negotiations have become much more difficult for clinicians as they try to support their clinical practices. The primary care impact has fallen on family practice and pediatrics particularly, as private practices have been closing, hospitals have been vertically integrating by absorbing private practices, and basically less access from Alaskans is slowly evolving. Primary care being the critical access for the lowest cost care for Alaskans. Therefore, the bill sets a floor of 345% of CMS Medicare fee schedule as reimbursement for clinicians. This will protect, I believe, family practice and pediatric practices, keeping them viable. There's also a provision in there that the networks have to be adequate to provide enough diversity for Alaskans that they have a choice for clinicians. The bottom line, Mr. Chairman, is that you have received more than 60 letters of support. Predictably, the insurance industry opposes this, saying that they'll lose money and children may die. But you'll notice that while reimbursement for healthcare clinicians has been reduced, insurance premiums have continued to go up. Mr. Chairman, online is a Weston consultant named Jeff Davis for any questions. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Senator Geisel. Are there any questions for the bill sponsor or Mr. Jeff Davis at this time? We have some invited testifiers that asked to testify on this bill. First up is Gary Stranigan from Primera Blue Cross. Mr. Stranigan, welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Gary Stranigan from Primera Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Alaska, testifying opposed to Senate Bill 121. Primera is a not-for-profit health carrier serving Alaska since before statehood. We feel that efforts to promote the affordability of our products are key to continuing to be able to provide care for our customers. This is because affordability has become a gateway to restricting access to health insurance and health care. Now, I have a deck that I thought staff was going to display on my behalf, but I can share it if that's acceptable, Mr. Chair.
It is up before us.
Oh, it's up for you. Okay, splendid. I appreciate that. So on to the slide number two, if we can, and I'll just go through these quickly, respecting your time, and I appreciate the chance to do this, because I think some myth-busting is in order. There's a lot of time and energy spent talking about health insurance profits, and from Primera's vantage point, there's not very much to talk about. The vast share of the healthcare dollar, our premium dollars, are spent on care for our members, as you can see, with medical claims being nearly 70% and prescription drugs being nearly 16%, and the lion's share being some cats and dogs, taxes, commissions, admin, operator and company, and a little sliver for operating income. I'd like to also spend some time on the next slide, just talking about a couple different common codes. These are not cherry-picked. These are just common codes that are compared between our business in Washington and Alaska. We're a Blue Cross Blue Shield affiliate, and we do business only in Washington and Alaska. So this is our data. And for all of these procedures, this care is a lot more expensive in Alaska than it is in Washington State. And for the longest time, we were told that it was because of just the high cost of living in Alaska, and that's the main reason. We always suspected that it was the 80th percentile that was at the root of it. And if we can go to the next slide, the next slide shows the U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis. This is 2023 data. And it places Washington as being considerably more expensive as a place to live than Alaska. The cost of living is considerably higher in Washington than it is in Alaska now. And this is because in Washington, I'm painfully aware of this, being calling to you from Washington State, the taxes have gone up a lot. The cost of housing has risen dramatically. Childcare is very expensive here, as is things like eating out. Everything is expensive here, and Alaska has done a better job controlling those costs. So you should take credit for that. On the next slide, I just wanted to touch on some recommendations for sustainable affordability, and this is where we tie directly to Senate Bill 121. The top three recommendations are controverted by Senate Bill 121. And while well-intended, the 80th percentile rule had a profoundly negative impact on affordability in Alaska. And becoming Alaska becoming the most expensive, arguably, healthcare market on the planet. And post-repeal, healthcare costs haven't gone down, but the rate of their increase has gone down a lot, more so than any other place in the country where healthcare rate inflation rates have gone up a lot in recent years. And so the repeal has borne some fruit for Alaska, but it has been washed out by other inflationary factors here in Alaska, so it's hard to see. It's worth noting that Premier has one network for all of our products. So the higher rates that will be produced by Senate Bill 121 will necessarily be borne across the whole market, including self-insured businesses, as well as Taft-Hartley Trusts. Like Senate Bill 121, like the 8th percentile, would set an artificial floor for payments to providers, a floor that is nearly 3.5 times the Medicare rate. This will once again lead to healthcare inflation that outstrips the lower 48. Additionally, the network adequacy requirements that have been added to Senate Bill 121 address a non-existent problem and gives authority to specialty providers and hospitals to effectively veto insurance carriers, potentially nullifying the insurance market in the state. When the 80th percentile was implemented, there was an upside. It was put in place to stop balanced billing. With the federal No Surprises Act now in place, that is not true of Senate Bill 121. There is no upside, unless you're a specialty provider that wants to charge more. Senate Bill 121 does nothing to improve access or quality. Other states are contemplating reference-based pricing schemes, which is what this is, that attaches the price of a good to a reference, so CMS price for a service. In Washington in 2025, they implemented a bill that set a range of caps from 135% up to 200% of Medicare, depending on the type of service. The aim of the bill was to save the state money for their public and school employee insurance programs. Conversely, Senate Bill 121 suggests that the biggest problem with healthcare in Alaska is that it isn't expensive enough. Other states are experimenting with reference-based pricing to bring costs down. This bill would have the exact opposite impact. We urge you to not advance Senate Bill 121.
Thank you very much, Mr. Shanigan. Any questions from committee members? I have a question for Mr. Shanigan. Mr. Shanigan, this committee has heard significant testimony from providers, both in the committee and in written testimony, that their practices are being significantly financially impacted with the repeal of the 80th percentile and actions taken by insurance companies after that regulatory repeal. So we've heard from providers, you know, that they didn't know necessarily how much money they were making before, and now they're making even less money. And you've said, well, our company really isn't making much money. Someone is making a significant amount of money. So why is it that we have this problem if we hear about providers having very significant financial impacts, so much so that they're thinking about closing their practice because they can't really make enough money, and yet your insurance company still is having the struggles that you have told us about today at containing costs? What do we need to do differently in Alaska?
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the question. We could spend some time unpacking a sufficient answer to that thoughtful question. I will say that we're the only entity in the health insurance generally, is the only entity whose books are evaluated by a regulator and approved before we can sell a product. So we have to bring a product. This is what this product cost us last year. And this is how much we expect it, our actuaries expect it to cost us next year. And so these are the rates that we need. And all of that is reviewed and approved, all the expenses, all the claims. It's all built into the filings. And then we get a product approved before we can go and sell it. And that's simply that sort of accountability to a government agency is non-existent in the rest of the marketplace. And so I can't speak to the relative profitability or lack thereof of the rest of the providers, the participants in the provider space. I can say that data is beginning to come online because of federal transparency actions and state that required hospitals and others to report their financial conditions. And so in some cases, we are seeing some hospitals that are close to that break-even line, or in a few cases, in some years, below it. In other cases, we see hospitals that are doing exceedingly well. And so there could be some fruit to be harvested there. One of the things that I wanted to show that pie chart for was just to articulate how big of a slice of pie that we talk about when we're talking about the insurance ecosystem. And lawmakers have historically put pressure on that little slice of the pie. And the rest of it has grown without a ton of examination. And I can only suggest that there might be more fruit than the rest of the pie, if you will.
Thank you. Any further questions for Mr. Shanigan? Next, we have Brenda Snyder. Ms. Snyder, please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Bjorkman. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Brenda Snyder, and I serve as State Government Affairs Director for Aetna.
I'm joining you today from Puyallup, Washington, in opposition to Senate Bill 121. We appreciate the intent behind this legislation to improve access to care and ensure fair reimbursement. However, we believe Senate Bill 121 will have the opposite effect. It will significantly increase healthcare costs for Alaskans without meaningfully improving access. We understand the goal of establishing clearer network adequacy standards in Alaska. However, SB 121 relies on rigid, percentage-based contracting requirements that do not measure meaningful access to care. First, I want to highlight the progress Alaska has already made. Aetna strongly supported the repeal of the 80th percentile rule, which required insurers to pay out-of-network providers based on billed charges. That policy led to unsustainable cost growth, driving up premiums for employers and out-of-pocket costs for consumers. Today, the Federal No Surprises Act provides a balanced, market-based solution. It ensures providers are reimbursed fairly based on median in-network rates, while still allowing for independent dispute resolution when additional complexity is warranted. Importantly, because those median contracted rates are calculated based on local market conditions, Alaska's out-of-network reimbursement rates are already higher than those in the lower 48. The current out-of-network reimbursement rates for Alaska providers are approximately 185% of Medicare. SB 121 reverses that progress. By establishing a minimum reimbursement floor of 345% of Medicare for out-of-network services, this bill would dramatically increase costs by 86% across the system. These higher reimbursement levels will be passed directly to employers and consumers through higher premiums and higher out-of-pocket costs. For example, a moderately severe emergency room visit will increase in cost from roughly $300 for professional services up to over $550, thereby nearly doubling the out-of-pocket expense for anyone with coinsurance or a high-deductible plan. Likewise, even a simple 20-minute office visit would go from under $200 to over $350, again with corresponding increases in out-of-pocket costs. Second, SB 121 undermines how health plans manage cost and quality. Network design is a key tool that helps ensure patients receive high-quality, cost-effective care. Percentage-based requirements do not account for whether providers are accepting patients, meeting quality standards, or delivering timely access. Previous provider testimony indicated that Alaska needs greater network adequacy standards due to increasing trends towards narrow networks in other states. In Alaska specifically, Aetna does not use narrow networks. In fact, since the repeal of the 8th percentile rule, we have increased our provider network in the state by 155%, adding over 1,100 providers across all specialties, including behavioral health. SB 121's requirement to contact with 70 to 80% of providers in each specialty shifts negotiating leverage entirely to providers. This will lead to higher contracted rates and higher premiums for Alaskans. Finally, this bill risks distorting the healthcare market in ways that reduce, not improve, access over time. By mandating set reimbursement floors or above market-based negotiated rates, SB 121 interferes with normal contracting dynamics and limits the ability of plans to negotiate based on cost and quality. Over time, this weakens incentives for efficiency and value, contributes to higher overall healthcare spending, and reduces flexibility to design networks that meet the needs of different communities. In a market like Alaska, where provider supply is already constrained, these pressures can ultimately make covers less affordable and limit access as costs are passed on to employers and families. In closing, while we share the goal of improving access and affordability, SB 121 moves Alaska in the wrong direction. We respectfully urge the committee to oppose SB 121. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Snyder. Ms. Snyder, both you and Mr. Stranigan mentioned that balanced billing is no longer a concern. I can assure you that I have written multiple checks recently for balanced bills. So if balanced billing is not a concern, why am I still being balanced billed?
That's a really great question. Balanced billing is not a concern, I would say. I believe that what's happened with the No Surprises Act is that it's more in line with rates that are the median contracted rate, right? And so when we move from the out-of-network rate being a percent or, 80% of bill charges, whatever that might look like, now we have a much more clear understanding of what that looks like, and it's in line with median contracted rates, and so it's much more closely in line with the in-network rate. Now, a patient can decide if they want to go out-of-network or in-network for care. That's the patient's choice. They can totally do that, but they would understand there's going to be an out-of-network likely cost that's higher than the in-network cost, and that's kind of the patient's choice of how they want to proceed in what care they want to get. But the out-of-network care is now more closely resembling the in-network rate to try and keep that out-of-pocket cost for that patient down.
understood. Do you think there needs to be additional guidance given to primary care providers when they make referrals, that they refer people to in-network providers, or at least inform patients that the referrals they make are either in-network or out-of-network?
I do think that would certainly provide much more transparency and access for the patient to decide how they want to go forward. But I do also believe that patient, choice is still important in where they want to go. So I think it would be important for the patient to have that information and then make an informed decision for sure.
Understood. If 345% of Medicaid is too high for an out-of-network floor, what number would be acceptable?
So we believe that 185% of Medicare is acceptable as it currently is, as that is very much in line with the area median contracted rate. And so, when the NSA rule came about, it was very clear that it requires you looking at the, what is the cost of care in the geographic area. So we're not making that rate based off of the cost of care in the lower 48, based off the cost of care in other states. We're looking at what is the, area median contracted rate in Alaska, in nearby localities, and what does that look like? And that's where we came with that 185.
Understood. I think the reason why this number came about in the CS version W was because there was some analysis of state experience and what the state plans paid, and that number was about 345%. So what is the change there? Why is there such a big difference between 345 and 185?
I would need to defer to CRB on their specific numbers. I don't want to share data that's not mine specifically to share. But I would need to take that back to the CRB. I'm happy to follow up with you on that, though.
Understood. Thank you. Any further questions from committee members? Seeing and hearing none, this time we'll open public testimony on Senate Bill 121. Is there anyone in the room or online who wishes to testify to this item? Hearing and seeing no one, that brings Senate Bill 121 back before the committee. Senator Giesel had to step away because we are a bit over time, which is okay. Jane, do you have any comments that you'd like to make? You don't need to if you don't. We're good. So that brings Senate Bill 121 back before the committee. I would like to just make a couple of comments and just note that I believe strongly that in Alaska we would benefit as a legislature from some significant study and guidance on this issue as to how not only our state plan but our private insured market can achieve better results and lower health insurance costs through lower health care costs and experience that we pay for through health insurance premiums and medical bills. We have some significant issues, but the solution to those issues is not to do nothing and pretend that things will be okay eventually. That's certainly not the trend. As we saw the loss of the enhanced premium tax credits this fall, thousands of Alaskan families are now going out without insurance because the cost of health insurance is too high. In the same way, we have heard from many medical practices that those practices now are becoming financially unsustainable for them to continue to exist in Alaska. And so we have this kind of three things that people are looking for in healthcare, but it seems to me that we cannot possibly have all of the access that people desire at the price that they want, and then the quality that they want as well with that access. It seems like those three things are not attainable at the same time. It cannot be quality care and affordable and as much care as people want, because the demand and cost increases and escalation are really driven by use of care, which is what we've seen in self-assured plans across the state and other things. as a legislature, I am excited and looking forward to additional efforts made by those in legislative leadership and many of us to pursue additional study and additional knowledge on this topic of how we can bring overall plan costs and insurance costs down in the state. That's something that people really, really rely on for access, because if access to care means that they have to pay a deductible that's thousands of dollars, they don't really have access if they know that they're going to incur thousands and thousands of dollars of expense before they can actually be covered by an insurance product. The same way, the people who provide the care, they have to be paid at a market price that is fair to them as well. So we have here quite a pickle. So we'll move this bill along today because we do have to work on it more as a legislature and as a body. We need to get a hold of this situation because we need to find a solution. And as we move forward, a solution means taking action. It means not doing nothing. So is there any further committee discussion? Seeing and hearing none, what are the wishes of the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move to report committee substitute for Senate Bill 121, version 34, Lima Sierra 0282 /W, like in Wolf, from committee with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal notes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is there any objection? Seeing and hearing no objection, committee substitute for Senate Bill 121, version 34-LS0282/W is reported from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. Please remain after we adjourn to sign the committee report. The Senate Labor and Commerce Committee will meet next on Wednesday, April 15th, when we will take up Senate Bill 259, Property Tax Assessment Increases, and House Bill 243, Barbers and Hairdressers Board Licensing. As there is no further business to come before the committee today, we are adjourned at 3:13 p.m. Thank you, everyone.